Everyone has a fave Wendy's Frosty flavor. And when you're choosing from chocolate or vanilla, it's not that hard. But now there's all new Frosty Swirls and Frosty Fusions. So try picking your fave from Oreo Brownie Fusion, Pop-Tarts Strawberry Fusion, Strawberry Swirl, Brownie Batter Swirl, Caramel Swirl, and Caramel Crunch Fusion. Not so easy now, huh? For a fresh way to Frosty, gotta be Wendy's. Open till midnight or later.
At participating U.S. Wendy's, hours may vary by location. Oreo is a trademark of Mondelez International Group. Pop-Tarts is a trademark of Kellogg North America Co. LLC, used with permission.
You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
Hello, True Crime fans, and welcome back to the True Crime Never Sleeps show. As always, I'm your host, Larry Lees. Today's episode, we continue our series, The Zodiac Files. Before we get into today's episode, I'd like to remind you, you can leave your thoughts and comments in the comment section below. As always, let me know your thoughts on this case. And before you do that, do you think we'll ever figure out who the real Zodiac Killer is? Let me know. And with that, let's dive right in. In the summer of 1969, the Zodiac Killer wasn't merely lurking in the shadows. He was riding in broad daylight. His rampage of violence had already earned headlines, but it was his letters, ciphers, and escalating threats that gave him staying power in the media and collective memory. No ordinary criminal, the Zodiac orchestrated his crimes like acts in a psychological thriller, each accompanied by handwritten notes that taunted the police, terrified the public, and forced the media into a high-stakes ethical debate. Should they print his words? Tonight, we focus on this media phenomenon. At its core are two of the Zodiac's most unnerving communications. Letters sent to the San Francisco Chronicle on September 27, 1969, and a follow-up on October 13th that would push both the public and the press further into the grip of paranoia. These weren't just letters. They were announcements of identity, threats of mass murder, and puzzles, daring the police to play his game. On September 27, 1969, the Zodiac Killer mailed two letters to the San Francisco Chronicle. These letters followed the brutal attack on Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd at Lake Berryessa just 5 days earlier. In one of the letters, the Zodiac claimed responsibility for four murders, describing them as desperate and frenzied. This language was evocative, even poetic in its violence. It was also calculated. He knew how words would land in newsrooms and eventually on the front page. Also included was an unusual demand. He instructed the editors to print one of his ciphers in a very specific format, exactly 13 inches wide, 8 inches high. The line read, quote, "The cipher is to be published on the front page of your paper. It must be printed exactly 13 inches wide by 8 inches high." The implications were chilling. Was this a technical requirement for a bomb to detonate? A bluff? Or was it simply an act of psychological warfare, forcing the paper to consider the cost of disobedience? While the cipher content itself has not been fully decrypted, the tone and precision of the threat left no ambiguity. For the editors at the Chronicle, this posed a real and immediate dilemma. On the one hand, ignoring the demand could potentially put lives at risk if the threat was real. On the other hand, printing the killer's words would give him the attention he craved. It was a lose-lose situation, and in the end, they chose to comply. Before the September and October letters, the Zodiac first made national waves with a trio of communications sent on July 31, 1969, each addressed to a different Bay Area newspaper, the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Francisco Examiner, and the Vallejo Times-Herald. Like we mentioned in a previous episode, they were not casual ramblings. Each contained one-third of a cipher the killer claimed would reveal his identity. And when deciphered, the content was direct, saying, quote, "I'm the killer of the two teenagers last Christmas at Lake Herman. I've enclosed the cipher. If you do not print this cipher by afternoon of Friday, 1st of August, 69, I will go on a kill rampage Friday night." It was a threat wrapped in a demand, and the media had 24 hours to decide whether or not to comply. All three newspapers published their respective cipher sections on August 1st. With the hope that the urgency was a bluff, public safety outweighed concerns about giving a platform to a murderer. The cipher itself, now known as the 408-character cipher, was solved within a week by Donald and Betty Harden, a couple from Salinas, California. It didn't contain a name, but it did offer insight into the killer's mindset. saying, quote, "I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all." This confirmed what many had feared. This wasn't someone motivated by revenge or necessity. The Zodiac killed for pleasure, and worse, he wanted the world to know about it. By September 1969, the Zodiac Killer wasn't just a criminal. He had become a media figure. His carefully crafted letters, bombastic language, and eerie demands had begun to shape how the press covered crime itself. For editors and journalists at major newspapers like the Chronicle, the Examiner, and the Vallejo Times-Herald, each new Zodiac communication forced a high-stakes editorial decision, and every time they chose to publish his words, they were reinforcing his influence and feeding the public obsession. The killer's now iconic phrase, "This is the Zodiac speaking," began appearing in bold font across front pages. In one striking example, the Chronicle printed this line as the centerpiece of a late October issue, giving readers the chilling experience of seeing the killer's words not just quoted, but shouted in large type. In effect, the Zodiac wasn't just controlling the content of the news, he was dictating its tone.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Newspapers, once seen as the filters of civic discourse, found themselves in a strange position, both gatekeepers and amplifiers of a murderer's manifesto. Zodiac's rhetorical choices weren't accidental. He wrote with a flair that mimicked headlines. Short sentences, dramatic language, and clear signposting. His constant use of "I am the Zodiac" and his crosshair symbol made his communications instantly recognizable and impossible to ignore. He often included instructions about how and when to print his messages. His demand that one cipher be printed in a precise 13-by-8-inch box was not only an act of control, it was a reminder to the staff that he was calling the shots. The press had to ask itself, if we refuse to print this and someone dies, is that our responsibility? Many editors justified their decision by arguing that the public had a right to know. Others cited the possibility that complying with the Zodiac's demands might prevent further killings. Some, however, privately expressed deep unease at giving the killer the exact notoriety he so clearly craved. Public appetite for Zodiac coverage was enormous. Newspapers saw surges in its circulation when new letters or developments were reported. Readers devoured every word of his taunts, looking for clues or patterns. Letter to the editor sections became filled with speculation, armchair theories, and requests for more information. But increased readership came with increased pressure. Some journalists felt they were being manipulated and becoming unwitting collaborators in Zodiac's psychological war. The killer's words were no longer just threats, they were content. The ethical debate inside newsrooms were real and complex. In the interviews years later, Chronicle staff admitted that they feared both the killer and their readers. If they withheld a letter and someone died, they would be blamed. But if they printed it, they were abetting the killer's theatrical terrorism. Over time, a strange kind of relationship emerged between the Zodiac and the Chronicle. He referred to the paper as if it were a personal correspondent. In one letter, he even commented on a police sketch they'd published, suggesting they had gotten his appearance wrong. This gave the chilling impression that he was not only reading the paper, but critiquing its editorial choices. The Zodiac was highly attuned to his media presence. He adjusted his tone to maximize impact, alternating between sardonic sarcasm and grim boasts. His public image was shaped as much by what the media chose to emphasize as by what he actually said. Excuse me. At one point, he included diagrams of bombs and discussed targeting buses. The newspapers published this, redacting only certain elements after consulting law enforcement. But even with redactions, the message is clear. The killer was setting the editorial agenda. He had created a scenario in which not printing his words was potentially more dangerous than printing them. Ultimately, the press became one of the Zodiac's most effective tools. Through it, he reached millions. Through it, he maintained his reign of fear. And through it, he sculpted a persona that has endured for decades. Excuse me. So now we're going to look into a couple uncomfortable questions that have been asked. Should newspapers print letters from a killer? Can public interest justify platforming evil? And when fear is the goal, does coverage amplify the crime? In the Zodiac's case, the answer seemed to be yes. The newspapers, despite their hesitations, became his loudspeaker. They didn't invent the fear, but they helped broadcast it. While newspapers captured his words in print, talk radio carried them into living rooms and car stereos. Hosts on KGO AM and other Bay Area stations spent hours dissecting the Zodiac's letters, speculating about his identity, debating the authenticity of the ciphers, and fielding calls from terrified listeners. Some callers theorized that he was a Vietnam veteran. Others claimed he was part of a satanic cult or an ex-police officer. A few went so far as to accuse their neighbors. The airwaves became saturated with Zodiac talk. There were even rumors of hoaxers calling in to impersonate him. Authorities had to investigate each case seriously. After all, one of these could have been the real killer. This blend of news, speculation, and entertainment created an atmosphere where fear became a form of passive participation. The Zodiac wasn't just a killer. He was a conversational constant lurking between weather reports and sports scores. As the number of letters increased and Zodiac's crimes moved across jurisdictional lines, from Vallejo to Napa to San Francisco, California law enforcement agencies found themselves in uncharted territory. The killer was unpredictable, mobile, and media savvy. The San Francisco Police Department, the Vallejo Police Department, and Napa County Sheriff's Office were all pulled into the investigation, but jurisdictional barriers and a lack of centralized communication initially hindered process. Different agencies had their own evidence files, suspect lists, and theories. It wasn't until late 1969 that the FBI formally joined the investigation. Their role was to manage the interstate nature of the letters and help analyze the ciphers and postmarks. A multi-agency task force was created, albeit informally, to track all communications and suspects. Despite increased collaboration, Zodiac appeared to be monitoring police behavior and used his letters to criticize their slow response times and inability to catch him. In one of his October letters, he wrote, quote, "The SF police could have caught me last night if they had searched the park properly." This was a reference to Presidio Heights, where he murdered Paul Stein. The claim only deepened public frustration with the police and raised the possibility that Zodiac had insider knowledge or was simply lucky. Less than 3 weeks after the September 27th letter, another communication arrived at the Chronicle. This time, the stakes were raised. The letter, postmarked October 13th, 1969, included a swatch of blood-soaked fabric, later confirmed to have been torn from the shirt of Paul Stein, a cab driver shot in San Francisco's upscale Presidio Heights neighborhood just 2 days earlier. This letter proved definitively that the Zodiac was not bluffing. He was escalating. He opened with, quote, "This is the Zodiac speaking. I am the murderer of the taxi driver over by Washington Street and Maple Street last night." He then mocked the police for failing to catch him and detailed how he wiped the cab down and walked away. But most disturbing was what came next. He threatened to shoot school children, claiming he would pick off kiddies as they come bouncing out of a school bus. This threat sparked widespread panic. School districts across Northern California enacted emergency safety protocols. Parents demanded armed escorts. Some bus drivers even changed routes or times without notice. The press coverage of this particular threat was widespread, and once again, editors were left to question their role in amplifying the killer's message. But the chilling proof, a piece of Stein's shirt, left no room for minimizing his credibility. His threats had to be taken seriously. The October 13th letter's warning that he would target a school bus changed everything. The image was horrifying and credible enough that the police presence on bus routes became standard throughout Northern California. School districts canceled field trips. Officers in unmarked vehicles began trailing school buses. Some districts worked with parents to create private transport systems. Though no attack on a school bus ever occurred, the mere threat had lasting effects. School attendance dropped. After school activities were suspended, parents called newspapers demanding to know why the killer was being given attention. The Zodiac had effectively altered childhood routines across an entire region with a single paragraph. The Zodiac's early letters were almost theatrical. He used ornate language, elaborate ciphers, and long passages, boasting about his superiority over the police. But as 1969 wore on, his writing style began to change. The September 27th and October 13th letters were tighter, more direct. He dropped flowery prose in favor of short bursts and terrifying specificity. Instead of broad allusions to slaves in paradise, as he originally used in his July 31st letter, he now wrote about aiming rifles at school buses and taunted police for their incompetence. He still included symbols, particularly the crosshair signature that marked each communication, but now seemed less focused on building puzzles and more on broadcasting dominance. Later letters, including those sent into 1970 and beyond, would continue this trend. The Zodiac didn't fade away. He evolved. He adapted his communication style like a performer adjusting to an audience. In his audience, the Bay Area was riveted. The repeated demands from Zodiac to publish his ciphers and messages forced newspaper editors into ethically murky waters. Editors at the Chronicle, led by editor Scott Newall and reporter Paul Avery, faced constant pressure to balance public interest with public safety. In an internal meeting after the October 13th letter, editors debated whether publishing Zodiac's threats would lead to further violence. Some argued that he was using the press as an extension of his crimes, that each word printed was another victim in psychological terms. Others countered that withholding his communications could provoke even worse retaliation. Ultimately, most of his messages were printed, though often with disclaimers or heavy commentary. Avery himself would later become personally involved when the Zodiac mentioned him by name in a letter, sending a Halloween card addressed to Paul Avery with the message, "Peekaboo, you're doomed." From that point on, the lines between journalist, investigator, and target were permanently blurred. By the fall of 1969, the Zodiac ciphers had taken on a life of their own. Amateur cryptographers, puzzle enthusiasts, and college students attempted to crack the symbols that peppered his letters. The Z408 cipher has been solved, but the killer's later ciphers, most notably the 340-character cipher, remained unsolved until 2020, over 50 years later. The Z340 was sent on November 8, 1969. For decades, it confounded experts until a team of international codebreakers used a custom-built cipher-solving program to decode it. The solution echoed Zodiac's earlier theme, saying, quote, "I hope you are having lots of fun and trying to catch me. I'm not afraid of the gas chamber, because it will send me to paradise all the sooner." Although it still didn't reveal his identity, the decoding effort renewed interest in the case and demonstrated how far ahead of his time the Zodiac had been in designing puzzles that could resist analysis for decades. As Zodiac's legend grew, so did the number of false leads and hoaxes. Police received hundreds of letters claiming to be from the Zodiac, and not all were genuine. Some were crude imitations with no insider knowledge. Others were carefully written but failed to match the handwriting or tone of earlier communications. The SFPD began handwriting comparisons and linguistic analysis to determine authenticity. In later years, it was estimated that nearly half the letters attributed to the Zodiac were likely fakes. However, the core series from July 1969 through 71 remained largely consistent in tone, content, and postmark origin. The confusion only compounded public anxiety. If anyone could write a letter and pretend to be the Zodiac, then how many more killers were truly out there? The myth was now bigger than the man. What made the Zodiac truly different from other killers of his time, like Charles Manson or the Boston Strangler, was his ability to control people without ever confronting them. He didn't need to be seen, he didn't need to strike often, he created rituals of fear, newspaper printing threats, school officials creating policies, police departments forming task forces, and everyday people modifying their lives, all because of someone who communicated largely through envelopes and stamps. This was psychological terrorism before the term was used, and the press, despite their best efforts, couldn't help but amplify his reach. By the end of 1969, the Zodiac had murdered at least 5 people and claimed over 30, evaded capture repeatedly, and inserted himself into homes across America, not with violence, but with language. His letters were not just afterthoughts. They were instruments of fear, tools of manipulation, and performances in their own right. They forced newspapers to compromise their principles, pushed police departments to share jurisdictional control, and left parents afraid to let their children ride the bus. In doing so, the Zodiac created a terrifying legacy, a killer who didn't just kill, but broadcast his crimes like press releases. He changed not just how we investigate crimes, but how we read about them, talk about them, and remember them. Even today, the question lingers. Was the Zodiac's deadliest weapon a gun or a pen? You can let me know in the comment section below. And that is our episode for this week. Let me know your thoughts in the comment section below. And as always, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee. Buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. Every dollar you give goes right back into the channel to help us create even more content, upgrade our equipment, bring in new hosts, be able to pay them, and hopefully one day take this show on the road. As always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We will see you next time.